coffee is usually rocks, and they don't move very fast. So.
Shuli Mishkin, April 2018, Tanakh and Archaeology.
First of all, does everybody have source sheets? If not, they're up here for anybody who did not get. In my real life, I'm a tour guide, and I don't usually stand in a room and have slides, and that's why I'm not used to them. But we're going to take some of the touring. We're going to try to bring the land of Israel into a shul in Teaneck, which is a good trick to do. Our topic is Tanakh and archaeology. Do the two go? How can the two travel together? Can they travel together? We'll start with a little story just in honor of Yom HaTzmaut. In 1928, 90 years ago, there was a new kibbutz in the Jezreel Valley. It was called Beit Alpha, founded by Jewish Olim from Poland. And as they were starting to put in irrigation channels, they very quickly realized that it wasn't just dirt that they were touching when they were digging, and they were uncovering a floor. And they uncovered it, and they found a mosaic floor that they quickly realized that it was a Beit Knesset, it was a synagogue, from the 5th century, and it was just this unbelievable feeling of, here we have this distant hello from the past, from the last Jewish community that had lived there in a place with the exact same name. They knew the name from the Arabs, Chirvit Beit Alpha, and they called it Beit Alpha, and here was this hello from the past. Now, today, so often in Israel, when you're, you know, building a new highway or expanding a house, you often come across archaeology, and it's always amazing. But this was one of the first times, and it was the first time that it was an excavation that was done by a Jewish archaeologist under the auspices of Israel, Professor Eliezer Kusukenik, who's later involved with the Dead Sea Scrolls, and this feeling of hello from the past, right? The past and the present and the future connecting. Was an amazing one, and I think it still is for people who are excited about Israel and are excited about archaeology. And whether or not Tanakh helps us to understand, archaeology helps us to understand Tanakh or not, that feeling of connection was a very, very deep one for the first Jewish pioneers, for the first generations of Zionists, and I think it still is today. And that's really the idea behind having this talk right before Yom HaTzmaut, to connect you to the land, to connect the Tanakh to the land. So our question is, Tanakh and archaeology, do they go together? How do they complement each other? Can they contradict each other? What happens? And the idea of looking at the land to learn more about the Tanakh is an old idea that starts out quite a long time ago and then skips many generations. So we're going to take a look at a few archaeologists. We're going to start, we don't have him up here yet, but we're going to start with one of the most extraordinary, he would not have called himself an archaeologist, but a scholar, and that's somebody named Eshtori HaParchi. I don't know if anybody's ever heard of Eshtori HaParchi, if you know of Eshtori HaParchi Street in Tel Aviv. Eshtori HaParchi, as you can see, is way before anybody else on this list, okay? 13th, 14th century. He comes from Tours, Eshtori Ish Tours, right? From France. He has a very difficult life. He writes about his life in the introduction to his book, Kaftor Baperach, how this is a time period, a very difficult time period. If you are a Jewish historian, you know this is a very hard time period where Jews are being sent from one place to another, expelled from this part of Western Europe and that part of Western Europe. And he writes about the trials and tribulations until he finally decides, enough with Europe, he's going to come to the land of Israel. Which wasn't such an easy place to come to either in the 14th century. But that's what he decides he's going to do. He goes to Jerusalem, and this is all in his introduction. He says, I couldn't live in Jerusalem. I apologize for the people behind the pole there. You might want to move over. I couldn't live in Jerusalem because there's too much controversy and too much fighting. And instead, I picked myself up and I went to the most beautiful place in the land, Beit She'an. Right? That usually gets a laugh from people who have been to Beit She'an. But that's where he decides to go. And he decides that he's going to write this book, Kaftor Vaperach, all about the sites of Tanakh and where they are in the land of Israel. Now you have to realize this is a completely revolutionary idea. Okay, up until this point, basically, if you came to the land of Israel, if you were able to make it on this terrible journey to the land of Israel, and you wanted to see the sites that are written about in Tanakh, so you hired a tour guide, which they weren't quite like the tour guides of today, and basically they would take you anywhere that was convenient and say, oh, this is the tree, this is the Alon of Avraham, and this is the rock where Yaakov put his head. Okay, not so much. But he really went out there and tried to find things, and he established principles that we still use today. Okay, just to give you one example, the most important example, he understood that the Arabs who conquered the land in the 7th century most of the time didn't bother to change names. So if you have a place that sounds like Beit El, Bitin, okay, and it's in more or less the same place where Beit El should be, then probably it is Beit El, and we still use that principle today. And this is Ashtoria Parchi in the 14th century, and he is a forerunner of this whole idea of what can I get from the land in order to understand the Tanakh better and more deeply. We move ahead to Sir William Flinders Petrie, who you might be able to guess was not a Jew, just based on his name. But Sir William Flinders Petrie was one of the most important early archaeologists. He's the first of Egyptologists, goes to Egypt, he studies, he finds all kinds of things. He's incredibly significant in finding, he finds a very, very important find called the Merneptah Stela, but he's very significant because up until his time, basically archaeologists are treasure hunters. All right, I'm going to find the treasures, the tomb of King Tut, the treasures of this and that and the other thing, they're plunderers. He is a scientist, or as much of a scientist as archaeologists are. Okay? And he understands that you have to look at the layers and understand the layers, and he developed something that's called stratigraphy, where you basically say what's up on top is later, what's up on the bottom, what's down on the bottom is earlier, and I can figure out and I can date things. And he is one of the first real archaeologists, and of course he relies on the Bible very much. Coming after him, you have William Foxwell Albright, also Christian Bible scholar, but deeply, deeply relies on Tanakh, relies on the Bible, and schools a whole generation of students in using the Tanakh and the land together, studying them together to understand how they go together. From Christian Bible scholars and people who are depending on religion to understand Tanakh, we come to a new generation, exemplified by Yigael Yadin. Yigael Yadin, one of the real rock stars of archaeology, of Israeli archaeology, the son of the aforementioned Eliezer Sukenik, but obviously very important in his own right. He's probably most famous for digging Masada. He excavates Masada. But he is a military man. He's one of these amazing, you know, new Jews, right? New Israelis. He's a general, and he's an archaeologist, and he's a historian. He's everything. What he is not is religious. He is in no way religious at all, and yet he knows his Tanakh backwards and forwards. And as he digs in the 1950s and the 1960s, he says, unabashedly, I dig with a spade in one hand and a Bible in the other, which is something that no archaeologist would say today. It could have pay us down to the floor. You would never say that today. But in the 1950s, this is part of the whole idea of Zionism as a way of reconnecting to our roots and understanding where we come from, and that we're returning to the land and not arriving in the land. And he very much believes that. And we're going to see some of the things that he discovers. We'll talk about Chatzor for a few minutes, or the picture that you saw at the very beginning of Gezer. Okay, he excavates in two of the three cities, major cities that are built by Shlomo outside of Yerushalayim, Chatzor and Megiddo. He doesn't excavate in Gezer. And he says, Tanakh says that King Solomon built all three of these cities. Therefore, they're going to have the same urban planning. And if I'm going to find a six-chambered gate in Megiddo, I'm going to find it in Chatzor. And he actually draws for his workers on the ground the outline of what he says they're going to find. And they find it. And he says, Tanakh is going to tell us, show us the way. And that's a good generation of Israeli archaeologists following in the footsteps of Yigael Yadin. So no conflict. Tanakh, archaeology, one informs the other. Very, very nice. Except that now the pendulum is going to swing in the other direction. Okay, that's where we get to another very important scholar, Professor Yisrael Finkelstein. Okay, first person we've had so far who's still alive. Professor Yisrael Finkelstein, Tel Aviv University. And this is where we get to a new phenomenon. And this is in the 1980s and the 1990s, where you get to something called minimalism, okay, where Professor Finkelstein is actually one of the lesser proponents. He's not a radical minimalist, but he's a good example because he's an Israeli archaeologist and he digs and he has a lot of experience. He's not just giving you theories out of the air. And he says, like many others of the time, everything in Tanakh, starting from creation and going at least to the time of Eliyahu and Ahav, is at best kind of exaggerated, but more likely mythological. Right? You cannot take any of those things at face value. They've all been written much later. All the stories about King David and King Solomon and their wealth and what they've built and what they've done, written many, many generations later, and it's all built up out of either nothing or something very, very small. And that's really where the status is in the 80s and the 90s, a great skepticism about Tanakh and what it can show us and what it can teach us. And that held for a very long time. And the pendulum has swung back, and our final poster child here is somebody named Eilat Mazar. Eilat Mazar has a very good pedigree. She has yichus. She is the granddaughter of the archaeologist Binyamin Mazar. She is the cousin of another very prominent archaeologist, Amichai Mazar, and she's pretty good herself. Okay? And she's digging all over the place in Yerushalayim, in the City of David, in the Ophel excavations. And she is swinging in the other direction. And she's saying, no, 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 don't be so quick to dismiss what Tanakh has to say. If Tanakh says David was a great king, we are going to find evidence of that. Now, she finds extraordinary things. What people don't like about her is that she often tells you what she's found before she's found it. Okay? People don't like that. Okay? So she says, I'm going to find King David's palace. And she finds a structure from the 10th century that is very possibly King David's palace. But the pendulum now swings to the other direction. And we're finding more and more. The site we're going to talk about is not Eilat Mazar's site. It's a site dug by somebody else named Yossi Garfinkel, who also relies greatly on Tanakh. And that's Kayafa, but more and more sites are starting to pop up that are saying, but wait, let's take another look. Okay? Don't be so quick to dismiss Tanakh. And the way the research stands today is obviously you have, I mean, we're Jews after all, and this is Israel, Jews, you know, multiplied, many, many, many opinions, okay, many, and some people hold more minimalist and some people hold more maximalist. Most people fall somewhere in the middle, and that's really what we're going to try to look at and we're going to try to understand. Just one more important idea that we're not going to talk about so much today, but it's nice to know about. Much more of an emphasis in the last 50 years on using the land, not only archaeology, but the land, its topography, its nature, its natural resources, to understand Tanakh. Okay? Today, I don't know how many people have ever gone to Israel for the Yemei Yun in Tanakh in Mechlel Herzog in the summer, or if you've studied more kind of Israeli school of Tanakh, the approach is, let's understand the topography, let's understand the geography, let's understand all the different elements of Eretz Yisrael, Torah to Eretz Yisrael, the Torah of the land of Israel. And this is something that's done in lots of places. It starts with a very important figure named Noga HaRuveni, if anybody's ever been to Neo Kedumim. Okay, Neo Kedumim is his baby. This idea that you can create a place that will teach you about the flora and fauna of Tanakh, so that when the Nevi'im use metaphors about plants, and Jews who've lived in the diaspora for hundreds and hundreds of years have never seen these plants, they don't understand anything about them, let's see them and let's be able to understand that when Mishle, right, when the scholar in Mishle says the laughter of a fool is like kisirim tachat hasir, okay, that there's a kind of a plant that when you light it on fire, it pops. It goes like popcorn. Pop, 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 pop. Right? And that's the kol haksil. That's how the foolish man, he laughs like that. Right? And all kinds of ideas like that. That's a side note, but important to understand. Okay, so some big questions and some big debates. We're going to skip this one and come back to it. Sorry. Now that I get to manipulate this, it's so exciting. Okay, what we mentioned before about Yigael Yadin. Okay, and this is just to give us an idea of how accurate is Tanakh. Can we use Tanakh as a source material? There is a reticence, a fear of using Tanakh. Because religion and Bible and politics and all sorts of other things. But realize that it's an unbelievable ancient source. To the extent that one scholar suggested maybe we should rebrand it and rename it the Library of Ancient Judea, and then people would use it, right? Like the Library of Ancient Moab. But there is this feeling of Tanakh is not a source in the same way that Homer is a source, or Stelas in Egypt or in Moab are a source. But just to give you an example from these three cities, right? If you look briefly on your source sheet, okay, on the second page where it says Solomon's Kingdom, okay, on the bottom, from Malachim Aleph, from the Book of Kings, V'zed Bar Hamas, Asher He'eleh HaMelech Shlomo, Livnot et Beit Hashem, Beit Beito, Bet Hamilo, Bet Chomat Yerushalayim, right? These are the taxes, or it's really a labor tax, that King Solomon levied in order to build God's house, i.e. the Beit HaMikdash, his house, the palace, the Milo and Chomat Yerushalayim, the extensions and the walls of Jerusalem, and then three cities, Bet Chatzor, Bet Megiddo, Bet Gezer. All right, so if you've traveled a little to Israel, you know that Chatzor is far up in the north, not far from Tzfat. Okay? Megiddo is in the Jezreel Valley, sort of in the middle. Okay? And Gezer is not far from Latrun, not so far from Beit Shemesh, between Beit Shemesh and Tel Aviv. These are King Solomon's three royal cities, right, distributed throughout the land. And it says clearly here that he built all of them. Finkelstein and other later scholars will say, that's a much later projection back into the past. Solomon didn't have such a big kingdom. How could that be? Right? Yigael Yadin in the 50s and the 60s reads this pasuk and he says, this is built by the same person. And therefore, if I'm going to find a six-chamber gate, and that's what you're seeing here, right, in Gezer, I'm going to find it in Megiddo, and I'm going to find it in Chatzor. And that's exactly what he finds. And this is the gates of Chatzor. The first, if you remember the first slide, that was the gates of Gezer. And you can see 1, 2, 3 chambers, 4, 5, 6 chambers. It looks better in real life. Come to Israel. And he found it exactly. So can we rely on that? On the one hand, this is an amazing example. On the other hand, we have certain things that even people who are very, very connected to Tanakh will take with a grain of salt. For example, numbers, right? The supplies that King Solomon supplies to his palace every month or every week, right? These crazy, crazy numbers. And you say, that must be exaggerated. The truth probably falls somewhere in the middle, right? So that's important to understand the accuracy of Tanakh. Question that we're going to deal with today, very important question, is, King David. King David takes up quite a bit of Tanakh. Okay? He's a pretty important guy. The ultra-minimalists, people who really discount much of Tanakh, said for many years there was no King David. Okay? People who are sort of in the middle, like Finkelstein, will say, okay, there was a King David, but he was a tribal chieftain. He was ruling over a small area. No way that he had the reach that Tanakh ascribes to him. Okay, so we'll get to that story when we talk about Caiaphas. But the idea that there was no such person, he never founded a dynasty, okay, that was pretty much agreed by everyone, disproved when this was discovered. What is this? Okay, this is part of something called a stela. Stela is basically a very large piece of stone that is the National Enquirer of the old days. Right? It's the news that, or maybe not the National Enquirer, it's the press release. Right? It's what the ruler puts out, what he wants to say to his people. Obviously, it's going to include a lot of positive spin from that ruler, so you have to take it with a grain of salt. Right? But when it does include the enemies, then you're going to understand that they're including it because these enemies actually existed. This was found in Tel Dan, Seminary in the far north by Professor Avraham Biran in the early 1990s. And what you see, well, first of all, writing. We'll get to writing in a little bit. But this is the language. These are the letters that are used throughout the whole area, not just in the land of Israel, but also in Aram and in Moab and in Ammon, everywhere. These are the ancient Hebrew alphabet. We're going to talk about the ancient Hebrew alphabet in a little bit. And the letters that are highlighted in white, say, anybody good Ketav Ivri reader? Beit David, okay? The triangles are deltas, are Ds, okay? Beit David. This is a list of conquests by the ruler of Aram, and I did this, and I did that, and I conquered the king of Israel, and I conquered the king of Beit David, of the house of David, okay? This is from the 9th century. We usually date King David to the 10th century, i.e. 100 years earlier. If a foreign king is writing about the house of David 100 years after David is supposed to have existed, there was a David. Right? And pretty much everybody agrees, and that's a very important idea. And we're going to get back to how powerful was David, but the idea that there was no David is pretty much disproved by this. All right? Other big questions that we're not going to deal with so much today, but are important to realize. Who are the Israelites, right? Who is Am Yisrael? Are we just, this is appropriate for Pesach, right? Are we just the people who came out of Egypt, or did other people join us along the way? Are we joined by Canaanites, right? That a lot of archaeology is talking about that now, but that's not something we're going to deal with right now. So before we can get to the specific example about King David and his possible royal city, Kir B'Kayafa, talk for another minute about what we can learn from Tanakh. So one of the very important principles that many scholars bring out is the idea that you cannot argue from silence. And the fact that nothing has been found that decisively proves the existence of Avraham or of Yitziat Mitzrayim is not a proof. Because if you look at the history of archaeology in the last 100 years, the things that have been discovered are so unbelievably astounding that nobody could have ever have predicted them. And no one knows what will be discovered next. So just to give you a few examples of things that have been discovered that change our understanding. Okay, so these are called ostraca. I always date myself when I say this. I say ostraca, they're little pieces of pottery, basically scrap pieces of pottery. I say these are the backs of the envelopes. I know nobody writes anything on the back of an envelope anymore. Everyone writes on their phones. Okay, but these are, for the old people here, the backs of envelopes of the old days. A piece of pottery breaks, you don't throw it out, you don't throw out anything in the old days, but you use this to write your grocery list, to write a draft of your letters, to write all kinds of things. And these are found in lots of places. So that's if you work in archaeological excavation and you find pottery, you never just say, oh, this is a boring piece of pottery. You always wash it and look at it carefully because there's often writing on it. And you can see, can you see that there's writing on it? Okay, these are ostraca from a place called Tel Arad in the south of Israel, a military fortress on the southern border of Israel from the end of the first temple period. And they're letters. They're all kinds of supply letters. Send us this, we need that, can you help us? All right, written by presumably somebody in the fortress. Now, that's exciting in and of itself because it tells us names, it tells us who was there, but more recently, the same professor Yisrael Finkelstein, by the way, had his students analyze these ostraca, and what the students discovered is that each one of these has a different handwriting. Why do we care? Because that means that there are many literate people in this remote fortress on the edge of the desert. If there are many literate people, then literacy is something that is widespread. And if literacy is widespread, then writing is also widespread. And that means that people who say, oh, Tanakh could not have been written down because no one knew how to read and write, and not so true. Lots of people know how to read and write. By the way, I'll always give this as a quiz. We'll see who's smart here. Okay, where do we know from Tanakh itself, a story, that people knew how to read and write? Eitan, asking you. Where do we know from Tanakh that people knew how, that everyday people on the street knew how to read and write? Great story. Anybody remember? Sefer Shoftim. Go home and study it. Okay. Anybody know? Okay. Sefer Shoftim, Book of Judges. Gideon, right, goes in battle, goes chasing after the Midianite generals, comes through a town, and he says, my soldiers, they're tired, they're hungry, they're thirsty, give us provisions. And the people in the town say, do you have the enemy in your hands? No. When you have the enemy, come back and then we'll talk. And Gideon says, you're going to be sorry about that. And he goes, he captures them, he comes back, and he picks a small boy, pulls a small boy off the street, and he says, write down for me the names of all the elders in the city. The kid on the street knows how to read and write. Okay, and that's a great example from Tanakh, but we also have it from archaeology. Just one other example like that. This is much older than the Arad, the Tel Arad Astraka. This is from a place called Izbit Sarta, or in Hebrew it's called Evan HaEzer. You may remember from Sefer Shmuel, major battle that happens there where the Aron is captured. This is today right next to the modern town of Rosh Ha'ayin. Okay. And what it is, it's from the 12th century, maybe even a little bit earlier, 12th, 11th century. And the first four lines, nobody knows what it is, okay? But the last line is actually an alphabet. It's an alphabet. There's a lot of interesting things to say about this. We're not going to talk about it now because we don't have time. But it's an alphabet. It's a very old alphabet. Why would you write an alphabet, stam, on a piece of pottery? We think it's somebody's homework. Right? It was somebody's homework. He had to go home and learn how to write the alphabet. And then what? My homework wasn't eaten by the dog. It was buried in an archaeological excavation. Okay, but that means that people were being taught how to read and write. And this is something that if you had asked a scholar 100 years ago how much literacy was there among the ancient Israelites, they would say, well, not very much. Right? But because we have this, we can say much, much more. Okay, another interesting thing that nobody would have ever expected to find. This is a fabulous story in and of itself. You may remember from Sefer Yoshua, from the book of Joshua, or from Sefer Dvarim, right? The commandment when you come into the land, give the blessings and the curses on the two mountains near Shechem, Har Gerizim and Har Ebal, and on Har Ebal, build an altar. Okay, about 25 years ago, an archaeologist named Adam Zartal found an altar on Har Ebal, dating based on all kinds of interesting things inside, not just pottery, but also artifacts from ancient Egypt, dating to the period of Joshua. Okay, it's a one-period altar. It only was around for a couple of decades. Okay, the scarabs that are found there are from Ramses II, the paro of the Exodus. This is the time period. This is the right time. And here it is coming alive from Sefer Yoshua. Definitely something that nobody would have ever expected to find. And the ultimate nobody would have ever expected to find is the Dead Sea Scrolls, right? Dead Sea Scrolls, we celebrated, right? 70 years to the Dead Sea Scrolls, November 1947. Bedouin shepherd boy finds scrolls in a cave that upend everybody's understanding about Second Temple times and the beginnings of Christianity and the beginnings of Rabbinic Judaism. Who would have ever thought that such a thing could have happened? So never say that we haven't found it. We haven't found it yet. Does that mean that we're going to find things that will prove everything in Tanakh? No. But there is definitely, you cannot close the door on anything. Okay, so we are going to talk about a very specific site. Some people may have been to that site, I don't know. It is called Chirbet Kayafa and is in a place called the Elah Valley. Okay, just to kind of locate you, the Elah Valley is in the area of Beit Shemesh, okay, between Beit Shemesh and Jerusalem. Nice big open valley, most famous because it is the place where the Battle of David and Goliath takes place, right? It's a nice kind of neutral zone. I don't know how nice it was, but a neutral zone between the mountains, which is where the Israelites are, right? Where Shevet Yehudah and Benjamin, that's where they are. And the sea, where the Plishtim are, where the Philistines are. This is a midpoint, okay? It's a neutral zone between the two, and that's why the battle takes place there. The Israelites come towards the west, the Philistines go towards the east, and they battle in the middle. About 10 years ago, 2008, there was a ranger, okay, an antiquities authority ranger, who was kind of going around in this area. They have to do that because there's a lot of theft, right? A lot of people, usually Arabs, who know where there are ancient sites and the archaeologists don't yet know. And they come and they take the antiquities. So the antiquities authority actually has set up a whole theft unit. And they go and they patrol and they see that everything is okay. And he came up to this area. And he saw something that looked a little interesting. He saw there was a fence made of kind of small stones, and he knew that was there. That wasn't anything very exciting, a pretty modern, few hundred years old fence. But this time, as he was going around, he noticed that there was a second layer that was almost completely buried underground of much larger stones. And he started to ask questions and say, oh, wait a second, maybe this is something older. And when they took aerial pictures, they discovered that those stones, that fence, was actually a complete circumference, right? It's a perfect circle, you could see it. Not perfect, but a complete circle. Okay? 700 meters, full wall. And they said, maybe we should excavate. So the ranger, Sargonor, contacted the Antiquities Authority, told them about it. They found an archaeologist named Yossi Garfinkel, and they started to dig in the site, which has the Arabic name of Kayafa. We're going to see that it was given a different site, a different name. We'll get to that soon. Okay, this is the wall we're talking about with the much larger stones underneath. Okay, and this is the site, and we are basically going to talk about Area B and Area C. Okay, the other stuff is nice, but not what's interesting for us. What you should immediately notice about this map is that there's something very strange about a small city that's surrounded by a wall, and that's that it has two gates. Okay, city, don't think about the old city of Jerusalem with its eight gates. That's much, much later. Okay? Ancient cities, okay, Megiddo, Gezer, Hatzor, Tel Sheva, anyone you want to mention, have one gate. Okay? A gate is not a good thing. A gate is a point of vulnerability. You don't want to have a lot of gates. The fact that something has two gates is very unusual. When they discovered the second gate, if you look back at your sources, you can see on the second page there, okay, they went back to their Tanakh, and they noticed that there was a name of a place that fits very nicely. A gate in Hebrew is a shar. Two gates is sha'arayim, like ofanayim, okay, like mishkafayim. Take a look, say for Yoshua in the Nachala of Yehuda, in the portion of Yehuda, okay, skip to the second part there. Bashpela, that's the area that we're in, the lowlands. Eshta'o, v'tzor'a, v'ashna, v'zanof, v'ein ganim, tapuach, v'ha'enam, yarmut, v'adulam, socho, v'azeka, that's where the David and Goliath story takes place, v'sha'arayim, v'aditayim, etc., etc. The Nachalot in Yoshua are listed geographically, okay? They go in order. And this fits perfectly. It's actually right between Socho and Azekah is this site. Is it Sha'arayim? We don't know. But it's mentioned again in the story of David and Goliath. Take a look in Shmuel Aleph. All right, this is the part of the story that nobody ever reads. Everybody reads until David knocks Goliath out, and then they close the book, but there actually is more. Vayaretz by David, vayamod al haplishti, vayikach karbo, vayishlefeo mita'ara, vayamiteo, right? He cuts his head off. Vayiru haplishtim, ki meit giboran bayanu, so they start to run away. Vayakumu anshei Yisrael v'yuda, vayariu v'yurdifu ta plishtim ad bochad gai v'ad sharei akron. They chase them all the way to plishtiland. Vayiplu chalalei plishtim baderech sha'arayim. The road going from Sha'arayim or to Sha'arayim, right? That's the road that they're chasing them on. Is this place Sha'arayim? Nobody's found a welcome to Sha'arayim sign yet, but it's a good guess. But that's not why it's important. Okay, why it's important is what they found there. Okay, so we are going to see that there are all kinds of interesting things that are going to connect us. The most important things for our purposes are when was this built and who lived in it. Okay, because if we understand the answers to those questions, here we have a strong, well-fortified city. If we can date it to a time period that important things happened in Tanakh, maybe we can connect it to some people who are connected there. Okay, so here are our gates, right? We've got our western gate. Both gates are exactly the same, right? Same dimensions, four chambers, right? Two rooms on each side with a ritual area nearby. Here's our southern gate. That was the one that was discovered first. Now, we'll get to when in a minute, but if I were to tell you the directions of the gates, could that tell us who lived there? Okay, so one gate faces towards the west. Okay, the western gate was the one that was found first. I don't remember if I said that wrong before. Okay, western gate, we're up on a hill in the Elah Valley. West means we're facing towards Plishtim. Okay, if we're facing towards Plishtim, is it more likely to be a Plishti site or an Israelite site? Philistine, right? Because I'm facing my friends. I don't want to have my gate face my enemies. And that was a suggestion when they uncovered that first gate. But then they came around and they saw that there's another gate in the south which has much more of an orientation towards the land of Judah, right, towards Israelites. It's basically a day's walk from Jerusalem. And they said, wait a second. Okay, and we're going to see. We haven't determined the ethnicity yet, but the gates are important in trying to understand where things are. When is this from? How do we date things in archaeology? So we started talking about Sir Flinders Petrie. Okay, and one of the very important things we learned from him is stratigraphy, pottery. Right? If I can find pottery that fits in my imaginary dictionary of pottery that I have in my head, meaning it matches, okay, to give us an example, right? If someone excavates my mother's kitchen in 500 years and finds Corel, okay, very nice. Sometime between 1980 and, I don't know, when did Corel stop being sold, 2000? Something there, right? Pottery is the same thing, okay? It's a silly example, but it's a good example. Okay? So pottery helps us to date things. What else helps us to date things? You guys are not giving me the main thing that everybody says right away, like it's a magic pill.
Fossils.
Fossils are very nice, but they're not very exact. Carbon-14, everybody loves carbon-14, right? Carbon-14, fabulous thing. Carbon-14 has two very big problems. Number one, it needs carbon, i.e. it needs something that was alive once, which doesn't necessarily last for 3,000 years. In the case of Kayapa, they found four olive pits. Four. One, two, three, four. Okay, that's it. Four olive pits. That's problem number one. Okay, it's useful, but you need to have carbon-based items. Problem number two, which is a bigger problem for our purposes, is that carbon-14 dating is not computers. Okay, it's not exact. It has a margin of error that is 40 to 50 years on each side. Okay, now if we are talking about is this King David or is it later? Okay, most archaeologists, Israel Finkelstein included, will say by the time of Omri and Achav, we're already on much surer footing in Tanakh. We have much more outside sources. How much time is between King David and Achav? About 70 years? Not very much. So carbon-14 is not super helpful. However, still, based on the pottery, based on the carbon-14, based on just the style, we date this to the 10th century, okay? 3,000 years ago. 3,000 years ago should ring many bells, okay? 3,000 years ago is King David. That's the time period that we're talking about. But the question we want to ask next is, we'll keep you in suspense for the question we want to ask next for a minute. What else did they find here right next to the Western Gate you guys looking at? Weapons, lots of weapons, okay? Lots of weapons, swords, spears, daggers, all kinds of weapons, buried, right, left behind. Now here's something we did not mention about Kayapa, which is important to understand. Kayapa stands for about one generation, okay? Less than 50 years. And then it's abandoned. Okay? Why, we'll perhaps try to answer later. But essentially, throughout Tanakh times, after the 10th century, there is no one living in this city. Okay? There's a small layer many hundreds of years later in the Hellenistic period, Second Temple times. For our purposes, that's not important at all. And then nothing again. Okay? But we have one time period and weapons left behind. Weapons... Philistine or Israelite? What do we say? Lots of weapons, metal weapons. Based on Tanakh, Israelites were not so good on the weapons, right? We didn't have people, the Philistines didn't allow us to make weapons. Maybe this already is a strike against this being Israelite. Maybe. We don't know. Why were they left behind? Metal is pretty rare. It's hard to make. We don't have answers for everything here. Ethnicity. How do we know who lives somewhere? Okay, what are the clues? What are we looking for that tell us who lives someplace? What would you say? What? If they have a mikvah, okay? Mikvah, everybody loves to give the answer mikvah. Mikvah is a beautiful answer in Second Temple times. There have been so far no mikvah found from First Temple times. It's okay, everybody gives the answer. Okay, so mikvah is beautiful. Mikvah is wonderful. Synagogue is wonderful, right? Inscriptions, mezuzahs, those are wonderful. Most of them are not found from First Temple times. We're striking them out. Yeah.
Animal bones.
Very nice. What do you mean by that? Okay, so one of the things that's fascinating about ancient Israel is that while they were very cavalier about idolatry, they didn't eat pigs. Okay, every generation has its own obsessions. Right? And they don't. Every Israelite site that we have uncovered that we can know is Israelite, based on inscriptions, based on all sorts of other things, does not have pig bones. So diet is very important. Good answer. Okay, we're not going to say if this is Kayafa yet, but what else? What else shows us ethnicity? What else could we point to? What?
Writing,
right? Anything that's written, of course, writing is going to be very helpful. What's the language? What does it say? Inscriptions. We're going to see that we do have writing from Kayafa. One thing is a name. It's going to be helpful. One thing we can't read, and that's not so helpful. Okay. Anything else that can tell us ethnicity? That can tell us about people who live there? Okay. So here's another example. Again. Archaeologists coming and unearthing my mother's kitchen are going to find 5 sets of dishes, okay? And they're going to say, this lady really liked dishes. No, they're going to say this lady followed some kind of strange dietary laws that she needed so many sets of dishes. Now, we don't have that from the time of Tanakh. People were not extravagant in that way. But we do have dishes that were more used by certain cultures and less used by other cultures. So I don't know if anybody knows what this is. This is a beer jug. Okay, the little holes are the giveaway because when you make beer, you have the hops, you have the barley inside. You don't want to drink that. So this is a strainer. It strains it out. Philistines are big-time beer drinkers. Israelites are not such big beer drinkers. Okay, so based on the type of pottery you're going to have, that's also going to tell you what type of people are there. Okay, so what's the answer? All right, is Kayafa an Israelite site? Is it a Philistine site? Is it a Canaanite site? Depends on who you ask. Okay, like anybody. Okay, the archaeologist who excavated the site say, based on many different things, that this is an Israelite site. What are they basing it on? Architecture and urban planning. Okay. There's a classic design to an Israelite city. The 4-chambered gates. A certain type of house that's built into the walls. Okay. Perhaps a ritual area near the gate. All these things seem to indicate an Israelite style of houses. Okay. So far, so good. Okay. Pig bones? No pig bones. Again, strike 4 Israelites. Beer jugs? Okay, we'll pretend to ignore the beer jugs for a moment. Okay, what about writing? So we're going to skip ahead. We're going to come back to these in a minute. Oh, we'll come back to you too. Don't worry. Sorry, I did this in the wrong direction. Okay, this is a jug that was discovered. I don't know if everybody can see. There's beautiful writing on the top. Okay, really nice ancient Hebrew writing. It looks even better in this one. Okay, I don't know if anybody can read it, but basically, what? No. Okay, it says Ish Baal Ben Bida. Okay, now the writing is clearly ancient Hebrew writing. It doesn't help us so much. Everybody in the region is using the same writing. What about the name? Ish Baal or Ish Baal? Israelite? What do we say? It has it in a Baal. Okay, is that a strike for us or against us? Okay. If you look in Divrei Hayamim, okay, we know that Shaul has a son whose name is Ish-Boshet. In Divrei Hayamim, he's called Ish-Baal. Why is he called Ish-Boshet, the man of shame? Because his real name is the man of Baal, the idolatrous god. Okay, so Ish-Baal seems to be an Israelite name. Okay, so that's one possibility. This is somebody's jug. He put his name, you know, wrote his name on his cup with marker. That's the equivalent of what you have there. Okay, so maybe that's also on the Israelite side. And this, which was discovered to great fanfare, is called the Kayafa Ostracon. Now you can see that it's very, very hard to see anything. And even when they were able to look at it under laser and they brought it to all these labs in the U.S. and serious analysis, they were able to see letters, but it's very hard to decipher what the letters mean. Okay, we could do a whole class on how to read ancient inscriptions, and do they read from right to left or from left to right, or my favorite one, as the ox plows, it goes like this. Okay, it's very hard to read ancient inscriptions, and even people who are expert in ancient inscriptions are not 100% sure what this says. Okay, so the Hebrew letters are very nice, but again, it doesn't prove 100% what this is. But one last thing that does lead us towards the Israelite idea is this. Well, we'll do the one before and then this one. Okay. Three small little boxes, two made out of clay, like this one, and the really beautiful one made out of stone, which is this one. What is it? What does it look like? Does it look like anything to you? It looks like an Aron Kodesh a little bit. Okay, it looks like a facade to a temple. If you look on the top of the third page here, okay, obviously very anachronistic, this is the Holy Land model of the second temple. But the doorway is the same doorway, okay? And you have it over here as well. What this is, we think, and we find it in Philistine sites as well and in Canaanite sites as well, it's a little shrine, okay? Now, what's special, what's different about this little shrine? Two things. Number one, it doesn't have an idol inside, okay? Philistine ones have an idol inside. Canaanite ones have an idol inside. Ah, the idol may have gotten lost. Very possible. But we didn't find it with an idol inside. Okay? Number two is the doorways. The doorway within doorway within doorway. Okay? If you look back at the second page here, okay, in the description of the first temple of King Solomon's temple, okay, Malachim Aleph Vav, that Petach Hadvir Asad Zlatot Asei Shemen Ha'ayil Mizuzot Chamishit. Okay, the Radak, Rabbi David Kimchi, reads that. He says, what does that mean? Okay, and he describes, he says, the ayil is hu hasaf ha'elyon, is the, what's the word, lintel? Okay, is the lintel. The mizuzot, hey masher mipo, right? That's why you need to draw and not write. Okay, they are the doorposts. All right, so we have architect in the audience. Asher asaf samuch aleihem. Okay, that the lintel is resting on. V'omer ki ayil ha'petach u'mizuzotav hayu b'tchunat chamishit shaita mizuzah chamesh tzlaot zo lifnim mizo. One doorway inside of another inside. This is the pattern that the temple uses. Is this a proto temple? Maybe, right? It's a fascinating idea. Could it be a proto-temple? So a lot of different elements in the site of Caiapha lead us to believe that this could be an Israelite site from the 10th century. Why is this a big deal? Okay, why do we care? Number one, if it's from the 10th century, it's from King David, if it's Israelite, because that's the ruler, right? That's the time period, that's the ruler. People who want to say King David was a very small, very localized king, just in Jerusalem, here we are on the border of Philistine territory. He's expanded greatly. It's a full day's walk from Jerusalem, and it's on the border in a rather dangerous area. So clearly he's a lot stronger than just a very localized tribal chieftain. It's a very fortified city. It's got this nice wall. It's got the gates. It's clearly built by somebody who has a lot of power. And it's got an administrative center. Why do I know that? That's what we skipped before. Okay? Anybody ever make those cookies where you stick your thumb in the middle? Okay? That's what this is, only in pottery. Okay? These are jar handles, and each one has a nice little thumb hole in it. Why? We think this is an early version of tax collecting. Okay, later on, the tax collector comes with jars that say on them, La Melech, the king. This is an earlier version. It's not so fancy, but it's a jar that has a thumbprint, that has an insignia in it. What that means is in Caiapha, they're collecting taxes. It's a central authority. And that tells you that this is a powerful city that is ruled by a powerful king whose reach and whose authority spread out. Does everybody agree with this? No. Okay? But many people do, and even the people who don't agree with it say that Caiapha is very much a game changer. It's a site that upends a lot of our ideas about this time period. But there are a lot of questions about it. Chief among them being, so what happened? Right? So much effort was put into this place. Why doesn't it last? Why doesn't it stick around longer? One of the other archaeologists working in this area, someone named Professor Aaron Mayer, who's excavating the site that we think is Tel Gat, right? Gat of the Plishtim. Gat is very close by, right? Due west of Caiapha. He says there's no way that Caiapha could have existed for long in the shadow of Gat. Gat was such a powerful Philistine city that eventually this city would have folded under the threat of a military attack from God. That's one suggestion. Another suggestion is the archaeologists who are digging just about a kilometer away, 2 kilometers away, in Tel Beit Shemesh, where they found a very big, very impressive, multi-layered city. And they say Kayafa is a little blip on the screen. The real story is in Beit Shemesh. That's where the real outpost was. So do we have any complete answers? No. But we have a lot more questions that open up the discussion more than it was opened before. And it's, it makes it much more difficult to dismiss the whole story of King David. What do we get out of this? Where do we go from this? And then I'm going to do 2 minutes on 1967. Can Tanakh help you with your faith as believing people? Can archaeology help you in understanding Tanakh? It can certainly help you. It can sometimes hinder you, by the way. There are many sites that disagree with Tanakh. I'll just give you one of the most famous examples, the story of Jericho, the story of Jericho. There is no layer from the time of the conquest of Joshua. The city is destroyed a few hundred years before, and it's only rebuilt hundreds of years later. What do we do with that? That's another lecture. Come back. But do the two go together? And I say yes, they do go together, because even when things are disproved, it still adds clarity. It helps us to understand. Does that mean it is the basis of your faith? No. There are certain things that, whether or not we ever find proof for them, the classic example, of course, being Yetziat Mitzrayim, the Exodus, it's a foundational belief. And there's nothing to talk about. But it does help us to understand. It does help us to see the context. And many things that are unclear from just learning Tanakh are often explicated by archaeology. Okay, because we're sort of still, for another month or so, in the 50 years from the Six-Day War, and I just wanted to spend 2 minutes at the end on some of the extraordinary discoveries that came out of that. Six-Day War, okay, that was last year's celebration. Now we're 70 years to Israel, but you know, we can give the Six-Day War another couple of weeks. Six-Day War was extraordinary on so many different levels, and one of the minor miracles, but a miracle nonetheless, is the archaeology. What did we discover after the Six-Day War that we did not know before? The most game-changing, the most unusual, is what was found in the Jewish quarter of the Old City. Okay, if you think about it for a second, what is the place that is the most exciting, the most important to excavate? A place that's been lived in for generation upon generation upon generation. What's the place that's the hardest to excavate? A place that's been lived in for generation. You can't come and knock on someone's door and say, "Hi, I want to dig." Okay, and here's where the story of the Jewish quarter is extraordinary. Okay? It's lived in continuously, essentially for 2,700 years. And what happens is, in 1948, it's conquered by the Jordanians. The Jews are thrown out. The major buildings, like the Chorva Synagogue, the Tiferet Yisrael Synagogue, are blown up. And the Jordanians don't really build anything to replace that. When Israel comes on June 7th, 1967, and conquers Har HaBayit and Jerusalem and the Jewish quarter, suddenly they have this area that is almost virgin territory. They don't have to knock anything down. And they make this very significant decision where they say, we need to excavate, we need to find what's underneath here while we are building. And it's an extraordinary project. I don't know if anybody here was in Jerusalem in those years of the late 60s, the early 70s. You see photographs from then. It's an enormous archaeological / construction site. They went to a very veteran archaeologist, the Antiquities Authority went to Professor Nachman Abigad, and they said, will you take on this project of excavating the Jewish quarter? I don't know, I'm going to retire. You'll dig for a year or two, and then you'll retire. He dug from 68 to 82, okay, basically round the year. Usually archaeological excavations are 6 to 8 weeks. This was 10 months of the year. Whenever it wasn't raining, they were digging. Okay, so it's essentially not 14 years. It's 14 years times at least 4. Okay, and they discovered everything ranging from the walls of the city from the time of King Chizkiyahu, okay, to the houses of the Kohanim and their mikvaot from the destruction of the Second Temple, to the burnt house, to Crusader markets. So I brought you one example, and that's the Cardo. Everybody who's been to Jerusalem has been to the Cardo. Major market street down the center of the city. built in Byzantine times, not a Jewish connection, right? But it's the only thing that Ahmanabhigad knew that he was going to find. How did he know he was going to find it? Because he had a picture of it. Right? If you go to Jordan, the end of the 19th century, there was a discovery of a church in a place called Medva. Right? And the church was covered with an extraordinary mosaic map of the land of Israel, only part of which survived. It's from the 5th century, Byzantine times. And the most outstanding part of it is a picture of Jerusalem. Hagia Polisa Jerusalem, the holy city of Jerusalem. And down the middle of the holy city of Jerusalem is a big street with pillars on either side. And Ahmanabhigad dug in exactly that place, and that's exactly what he found. Okay, the pillars were lying down, but close enough. Okay, so that's the cardo. Just to take us out of Jerusalem for a minute, surveys in places that had never really seen much archaeology, in particular the Golan Heights. Golan Heights, which had a very strong Jewish presence in Second Temple times, Mishnaic times, Talmudic times, and then not pretty much at all, never had an archaeological survey. Suddenly, after the Six-Day War, archaeologists descend on the Golan and they do a survey. And one of the places they're looking for is a place that's described by the Jewish historian of Second Temple times, Josephus. The last stand of the rebels, some people call it the Masada of the North, Gamla, right? That fascinating, horrific story. Okay? Josephus describes it as Gamla from the Hebrew word Gamal, a camel. And he says it's a steep precipice with deep cliffs all around, abysses on each side, looking like the hump of a camel. And Shmayahu Gutman, the archaeologist in the Golan Heights, who was doing the survey, and his students are walking around one day, and they see this, and they say, wow, that looks like the hump of a camel. And they start to dig, and they discover the wall, and they discover the towers, and they discover the synagogue, and it's an amazing thing. And the last thing we'll finish with is the Gamla Synagogue, one of the oldest synagogues ever to be discovered. Not to mention all the sites in Yehudan, Shomron, Shiloh, and Gush Etzion, and Hebron, and Beit El, etc., etc., etc. Many more things to talk about. So the Six-Day War is groundbreaking in archaeology as well. Many, many more things to discover in Tanakh and later times in archaeology. Thank you, everybody. Happy Yom HaAtzmaut. And come to Israel. Thank you. See it in person. Anybody have quick questions? Anyone have a question while we're the last few minutes?
I'm not certain that one of when they fought the battle, they went to the Tanakh, and that's how they...
There are certain famous places. I'll give you one example. And this is not Jews, actually. This is the British. Okay, the British fighting the Turks in World War I. And they come to an area near Beit El of today, and they're seeing the Turks are in their camp up there, and one of the British soldiers says, you know, this is, they see the Arab name, Michmas. And they say, and he was a good reader of his Bible, and he says, I remember there's a story about Jonathan, the son of Saul, and he goes and he sneaks up on the Philistine soldiers. Maybe we can do that. And they actually do it, and they recreate it, right? Or Ord Wingate. There are stories like that, right? Amazing stories.
Amazing.
Right? Using the topography and the story of Tanakh together
to see what the...
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, it's very interesting.
Are there other examples of, like, border towns, like we were discussing before, that have elements of civilizations?
So what's happening now in archaeology, one of the biggest things that are being discovered is this area of the Shvela, right? This area, this neutral zone. And that's the hottest question. Is it Canaanite? Is it Israelite? Is it Philistine? Does it transition at some point, right? And it's a very open question still. Right, and we're also not exactly talking about, you know, France and the United States. Everything is very close. I go shopping in Philistine stores. I bring home their pottery. So it's a very big question today.
How does Kayafa get its name?
Kayafa is the Arabic name. Okay, it's based on what it looks like. I don't remember the exact translation. Not Tanakh related in any way. Okay, in many cases the Arabs do retain the names, but not always. Not always.
Other cultures in the area eat pig?
The Philistines ate pig. Philistines are big pig eaters. Okay, the Canaanites eat pig too, but this exactly relates to your question. At a certain point, it seems that the Canaanites are so anti-Philistine that in protest, they maybe stop eating pig. We're not 100% sure, but Philistines, 100%. They are big chazer eaters. Yes? So burial is also a very interesting way to determine an ethnicity. We don't always have it. Okay? And again, often the styles are borrowed one from the other. Right? So let's say Philistines who lived near the Egyptian border, buried in, they're called anthropods. They look a lot like mummies. They're not really mummies, but they borrow the style. Philistines are master assimilators, but the Israelites do it too. Everybody borrows from everybody else. Remember, we're talking about a very small place, right? So that's one thing that makes it very tricky. But burial is definitely another way to determine an ethnicity.
Another question. I've gone with it in mosaics, so it's been the shul, the zodiac signs and everything.
Much later.
That was much later. Why did the shul use, they're not supposed to believe in the zodiac. So why does that use?
Have you ever gone to a bar mitzvah and on the tables there are like little Mets caps and, right? Everybody uses the culture that they're in. Does the significance of the symbol, do they retain the significance of the symbol? Not necessarily. Right, it's denuded of its religious significance at a certain point.
I remember once watching a show of the use of archaeology in Christianity, and like they're digging the land also in terms of their sort of New Testament. So I was just like thinking, are the results of that, like more, I guess, a little much later than the 10th century, obviously, but are the results of those digs similar in a way to what we find? Is there collaboration at all?
Look, Israeli archaeologists dig, first of all, they're Israeli archaeologists of all religions. Okay? One of my favorite sites is a place called Migdal, which is a Jewish town from Second Temple times that is being excavated by a Muslim Israeli archaeologist and is funded by Mexican Catholics. Okay? It's the best. Okay? Everybody is digging. The idea in archaeology is not to come with preconceptions, but to see what does the land show you. And ideally, you should not be bringing your beliefs, but of course everybody does, because that's the world. But it's not meant to be, I'm trying to think of the word that I want. In Hebrew, it's megamati. We don't want it to be with your program, right? Coming in with your agenda. You see what there is, but yes, you come with your beliefs, 100%. Everybody does. I'm sorry, this is going to be the last question, because I have to catch my bus. Yes?
Years ago, I invited down an Israeli archaeologist, and his topic was evidence of the CS and surrounding. So he went back and he dug all, and he found nothing. And everybody was very accepted to it. I invited him. Did anything change?
The other side is a very tricky topic. I will refer you, if you want to Google, the great article by Rabbi Josh Merman about this topic exactly. Physical evidence? No. Not yet, let's put it that way.
Evidence that so many people left, they should find something.
We're talking about nomads who are traveling from place to place from 3,500 years ago. So they're not necessarily giving evidence. However, in the story, there are so many references to contemporary Egyptian culture that we say there's a lot there. There's something there. The story, maybe not every detail, but the kernel of the story is definitely there. And that's a talk for another time, but if you're not sure that's right. A lot of the names, the places, the fact that, I'll just give you one example and I'll leave you that. Okay, the fact that what is Moshe's most important accessory? His staff. What does the Egyptian pharaoh have that shows his power? His staff. Without his staff, he's nothing. Right? And there are so many allusions to the Yodei Davar. People who understand what you're reading, they know what I'm talking about. So I don't know if that makes you feel better, but...
So before you go, how do we get in touch with you?
Oh, here.
Maybe you're forgetting the most important thing.
Cards. Okay, should I lose cards?
Yes.
Okay, I'm so sorry. I'm going to stay. You have us in 5 minutes.
You know what you can